You're listening to Subsound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the El Arpa Podcast. Welcome to the El Arpa Podcast. This is part one, and I'd like to thank you for listening so far over the last 2 years. We are now on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeart, and many other platforms. Now, on with the show. So, this is part two of the podcast. We mentioned in our Halloween podcast, very briefly towards the end of this segment in that show, about this three-part documentary series on Netflix called Five Came Back, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So, we'll involve you a little bit at the start.
Not very much.
Before I'll educate everybody with my thoughts. And, well, of course... that movie that's played every Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life, right? So you said your father always watched this movie.
Yes, he did. He did say it was beautiful, and well, I think it involves some kind of like godly help.
Exactly. Well, we'll come back to this towards the end of this part, because this is part of the story as well. This is covered in this three-part documentary series as well. So you have five directors, okay, and basically you have five modern directors talking about them and giving insight into their work and how they're feeling. So you have Steven Spielberg is one of them, Francis Ford Coppola is another, Guillermo del Toro from Mexico is another as well. You have Paul Greengrass, who's an English director of the Bourne Identity fame, also directed Matt Damon in The Green Zone. And I don't know what he's up to lately. I actually haven't seen any of his movies since since the Bourne franchise. And they're talking about Frank Capra, John Huston. They're talking about John Ford, William Wyler as well. So they're talking about all these directors who, when World War II came, they signed up and decided to serve in the armed forces, doing what they did best, which is making movies. Now... let's pause it there. This is the premise of the show, which I think is quite interesting. So if one of your favorite directors jumped up and went to a conflict to cover it out of a humanitarian angle or a socially conscious angle or this is history, so I have to capture it angle, would it provoke any special feelings either way? I can't believe this is happening, you know, the world of Hollywood merging with the world of real life.
Well, I think probably now it would be different, wouldn't it? It wouldn't have as much of an effect as it would have done then, I imagine.
I believe so. What are your reasons? So I can agree with them.
Well, just that, you know, now we're so, like, exposed to news and we get to see conflicts on, you know, every day and basically on real time from even from journalists that are there, and you know, anybody can grab a phone and record what is happening.
This is true. Well, what struck me when watching this, and also not only is this documentary on Netflix, but some of the films made by them, like The Battle of Midway, which is a documentary of the aforementioned battle, film by John Ford, is also on Netflix. It's like 40 minutes long, I think. maybe 20 in that kind of ballpark. But what you're seeing here is what we are so accustomed to now, which is the birth of modern documentary making and being a witness to unfolding and breaking news and unfolding events. And it's completely staggering because I never saw Second World War in this light, that these images were emerging like this, you know, because obviously I grew up watching World War II documentaries. Everybody, I think, has at least a passing fascination to the World War II, varying from passing to very intense. I used to buy a lot of Nazi books in college, and so did my friends, because we just had an interest. But then we looked at our bookshelves and thought, you know what, this does look a bit suspect, even though we have a healthy interest in historical facts. But and also I think as well, because, you know, the Second World War was a global conflict, which we don't have now. Well, in certain respects, I guess you could say we do have a global conflict of two philosophies, jihadism against Western civilization, which can strike anywhere, no? But of course, this isn't a six-year conflict involving most of the countries in the world. So, yeah, for that reason as well, and the one that you mentioned, it probably wouldn't have the same impact that it would have now. There's nothing that they could do, I guess, that would... they could produce interesting work, but it wouldn't be truly shocking, unless what they were filming was just a truly grotesque actor, or they're revealing something like Guantanamo proportions or that kind of stuff, no? So you're interested in World War II? How far does it extend? From passing to too many Nazi books, a la that priest and Father Ted?
Well, I studied history too, you know.
Yeah. Many Nazis in ancient Egypt?
No, but I studied contemporary history in my last year at university, the whole year. But, well, I wouldn't say I have a particular, you know... I have a general interest in it. I wouldn't go as far as like what you mentioned, but yes. Well, I would say in as much as it's an important part of the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah. Well, it's this documentary series is really great, because I think these men, who are all very different backgrounds. Weiler, who's a Jew. Capra, who's an Italian immigrant at the time, which wasn't treated very well in certain respects. They quote one article / profile of him where they call him a WOP quite brazenly, which of course is a racial epithet. So I think he was quite keen to establish himself through the American dream and make movies and be accepted as an American. John Ford, who was a tough talking Western director, and then John Huston, who was kind of man about town, ladies man, quite charismatic, and they all made different types of movies as well. William Wyler made romantic comedies, which he never returned to after the Second World War. He just never could, you know. And John Huston, who, you know, he made a lot of movies, a lot of like tough, taciturn movies about tough men, but also like sensitive movies. And even some of those sensitive movies have starred John Wayne, who was not a sensitive man. But particularly after the war as well, he made an anti-war movie about the boats that were operating in the naval aspect of the war. I can't remember the name of those boats, but John F. Kennedy was in one of these boats as well. And the actor playing the main role was also a war veteran. And the set was so realistic, it took him a couple of days to get the grips with it, and to really kind of just be okay with it. And John Ford, who wasn't a man, I guess, who was prone... Well, he was prone to kindness, but not all the time. But he said to the actor, look, you take as much time as you need, and we'll start rolling the cameras when you're ready. And on this movie as well, there's a scene where they have to salute John Wayne couldn't salute properly, apparently. And then John Ford shouted at him, "Damn it, man, can't you... salute like you're in the army or something like that." And then, you know, John Wayne was very upset. John Ford started crying because he realized like what he'd said, how hurtful it was. Also, maybe he was kind of processing emotions he hadn't properly processed, you know. So, but I'm jumping ahead of the game a little bit. Like, this is after the war. Like, you study contemporary politics. Do you know anything about American isolationism?
Yes, I
know. What do you know about it?
But you're gonna tell me more.
No, because I don't want to talk too much, because I don't want to dominate this podcast
Like, yeah, but you can do today because you...
No. Tell me about American isolationism. Pop quiz, hot chef.
Well, no, like, now you're putting me on the spot.
Well, where's the podcast? You're generally on the spot for, like, 20 minutes while we talk.
Okay, well, the word says it. Says it all, no? Well, yeah, like, at first, like, the United States didn't want to get involved.
Yeah.
In the war, and then it was only, like, at a later stage that that they did.
Yeah, with kind of reluctance.
Yeah, with reluctance, yeah, but kind of, like, yeah. I think partially that played into them sort of feeling like they just come in last minute to save the day.
Well, that was kind of the philosophy. Britain tried to woo them into the war by taking Bletchley Park and showing them the Enigma machine and how sophisticated it was. And they wanted to kind of like show, look, hey, how great this is. And if you help us, you can have access to this kind of...
movie.
What's that?
Disney movie.
Well, I didn't see the movie. But it's also history, so there's not only one source for this, you know. Okay, well, anyway. But yeah, so at this time, William Wyler, he made a movie about a British housewife who is confronted with a German pilot who was shot down. And basically, he was like a bad German, you know, and the studio wanted him to have like, don't like to demonize him too much. And he said, well, if I had five Germans, I could have a good German, a normal German, and a bad German, but I only have one German. And then after Pearl Harbor, maybe, the studio called him back and said, yeah, it's okay, you can continue with this bad German, you know. And there's like so many aspects in this podcast, you know, it's dangerous to go off into tangents. But for example, like the treatment of the Germans and the Japanese was very different in... like in the movies that they were asked to make in the propaganda movies, so the Japanese were shown as kind of almost half animal, while the Germans were treated with a kind of more humanity, and just caused a lot of ill ease and disquiet in the middle of the war and towards the end, because they knew like, well, I mean, we have to, like, when the war finishes, we can't have Americans hating every Japanese person. You know, Japanese people were treated with suspicion in the country and taken to kind of camps and and separated from population because they're viewed with suspicion. So I mean, like, it's so, like, I mean, there's so much detail in it. I if you have Netflix, I recommend watching it. If you don't have it, just get it for this and then cancel it if you want, because they're raising their prices in December anyway, to 13 euro per month. It's a free trial for a month. And then, for example, Capra, like, he was contracted by the government to do propaganda movies, and he started off watching like Leni Riefen style Nazi propaganda, you know, and he was so breathtaking by them, in the sense of like, you know, how can we beat them? Their propaganda is too good, you know. And they he made a documentary of different parts called Why We Fight, because he knew like these kids who were in the army weren't going to read, and he just was thinking in a very modern way, I guess, how can we reach these kids and make it like, you know, probably today it'd be a Twitter post or something. And there's like and he made this different parts documentary, and followers of Band of Brothers, there's an episode where they reach the concentration camps, which is based on a true story, but it's a HBO series, and it's the title of this chapter, of this episode, is Why We Fight, which I think is a reference to this Capra documentary series, and they use the German propaganda. So like, he said, we don't have the budget, or even like the, I don't know, the imagination maybe to make this, because the great movies that they eventually ended up making were just very naturalistic, capturing with a director's eye what was happening very beautifully. Well, the Nazi propaganda were these grand shows, you know. And apparently the British, they don't really go into too much detail, but the British were capable of doing these kind of propaganda movies as well, even though the Nazi ones were very singular and very unique in the scale of them. But they basically just used the footage of the Nazis and just put a narration over them, and showing how evil and corrupt they were, and how necessary it was to defeat them. And these movies were very successful as well, because it really did bring home the scale of the task in front of the free world, shall we say, and you know, why we had to fight, or why they had to fight, for example. So I mean, it's really interesting to see the power of movies, you know, these directors who make great movies before the war and actually went on to make their best movies after the war, and they could see, and the Nazis could see as well, like this new medium and how effective what's going to be in this global conflict. You know, there, I mean, everybody involved on both sides, like from these five directors, from Goebbels and Riefenstahl, and all, like they were just so plugged into this modern tool, and they were, not only were they plugged into it in the sense that they were aware of what it could do, but they actually could utilize it and bring about the things that they wanted to bring about through the medium. So like, we're both film fans, and a lot of people are obviously as well. So it's just that concept in itself, this premise, is really, really engaging, you know. Have you ever seen Triumph of the Will, for example?
No, I haven't.
Have you ever seen footage of Nuremberg rallies?
Well, yes, of course.
Excuse me. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, were you blown away?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's such a modern looking thing to do, you know. It's like we almost take it for granted that nowadays there's so much information and all the access that we have to the sources of information, but by then it was you know, really, really essential for people to get to know what was going on.
Yeah. And speaking a little bit as well about like the specific movies that they made, The Battle of Midway, for example. I mean, it's incredible. It's like he was going up really high, dangerous, exposed positions. You could see planes coming towards him and everything as well. And like a lot of movies they made at the start were propaganda pieces. And if they lost a few bombers, it was always the narration was always like, "And American planes come back without any casualties," you know.
Yeah.
But in this one, you can see like bodies and everything, and like the real forces of war.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed this to the American president,
mm-hmm.
and basically, you know, like the president was watching the documentary, and he's like, "Oh, that's a B-52 bomber. This is this kind of ship, you know." And then they showed a picture or an image of his son saluting, and the whole screening room went quiet and didn't speak until the end of the movie. And then the first thing they ever said after the end of the movie was, "We have to bring this movie to the cinemas," because the War Department were very cautious about showing movies that showed like the real effects of war, because they didn't want to discourage anybody from going to war.
I was going to say, they never have any problems, like, you know, from institutions basically not wanting them to show.
Well, there's a lot of there's a lot of fighting basically, but like John Ford, for example, in particular, was very good at getting what he wanted. So at the end, he was battle hardened in the sense of, well, he's fought with studios, he can fight with the army as well,
yeah.
And so yeah, that, and then I think because there's a book. Well, Stephen E. Ambrose, he's a very famous, he's dead now, but he was a very famous World War II historian, and he wrote the book Band of Brothers, going back to the HBO series, which is a real account of you know, Easy Company, who went all the way from Omaha Beach to the Eagle's Nest. And he wrote another book called A Citizen Soldier, which is about how, like, you know, the American war effort was, and of course the other countries as well. It was just, everybody was just drawn into this conflict, and people who weren't soldiers became soldiers, so university students, high school students, teachers, you know. You look, Saving Private Ryan, Tom Hanks is a baseball coach and a middle school teacher in the movie, for example. So so I think maybe this movie was kind of just showing that, like, it's not just, you know, this kind of broad stroke of good versus evil, or like, you know, oh, B-52 bomber and all this, but it's actually real American sons who are actually fighting this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And another great movie, which is also on Netflix and also on YouTube, it's the Memphis Belle, which is the bombers going up and dropping bombs. And Wyler, for example, the Jewish director, he was filming in this plane, and like, you know, if he'd been shot down, he would have been in a lot of trouble because of his religious faith. But again, and I showed you this clip, it's like, you know, like the War Department didn't want to release this, but you can hear them counting the bodies. You can see a B-52 bomber which has been just completely blown up and shot, and two pilots of a parachute out. You can see two parachutes start, they're counting the parachute, and it's just like, come on, damn it, get out, you know, and they're trying to count. Yeah. And in the final tally, it's like maybe five parachutes from a 10-man crew get out of it as well. So this is like real, again, you know, you don't see, even like when World War II in color came out maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it kind of added a new dimension to the war, but like, I've never seen World War II like this, where it's like just real men and real people having real reactions to, you know, like, come on, you son of a bitch. And there's people swearing, you know, and reacting to what was going on around him as well. And just the footage is absolutely incredible as well. So like, he was like really in there. And these, I mean, there are people who put themselves in danger just to tell a story and see, like, they had to get the shot, you know. Like, there's even a great story about how when the Nazis, I think when they surrendered in France, one of the five directors profiled in this documentary series was there. I think it was Wyler, but I must check that information. And they had to go into a church to sign the agreement, the surrender. And it was too dark, so he's worried about getting the shot, so he forced them to recreate it outside. So which is kind of funny. So it's Charles de Gaulle, and there's the Nazi leader in France. I think it was in France, yeah. So because he was thinking of this as a cinematic thing, you know. Yeah. And because most of the videos that they made were real. But I mentioned to you before, they did do recreations as well. And it's really, I mean, Steven Spielberg was saying about how there's this famous battle. I think it's in Japan. We had to do this battle, you know, and he didn't know it was fake until years later, because they're shelling places, they're climbing up hills, the camera pans around, and just as the camera pans around, some guy falls to the floor, and the director's giving him notes, look at the camera, because if it's a documentary, you're aware the camera's there, you're looking into the camera. If it's a movie, obviously you don't pay attention to the camera, so it's just feeding them these kind of Hollywood notes in the middle of a war, you know. It's really incredible, you know. Going towards the end of the war, it's, obviously the liberations of France and Holland and different countries and the concentration camps is really interesting, because they get really good footage there, and you can see the joy and the ecstasy and in the concentration camps. Frank Capra, he said, when you enter as a cameraman, you're their new captor. I'm not sure what he meant by that, but it's an interesting statement. He goes, when they touch you, you feel revulsion as well, because I guess they're all emaciated and dirty. And he said, that's a shocking thing to feel about yourself, that you have that kind of reaction to them as well. But he was particularly marked by the footage he shot there. And a lot of the team he had there, they stopped filming and just started helping the Jewish prisoners there and the other prisoners there, because they were so shocked by what they saw. And that footage came back to America, and it was never released. But I think he kept it in a warehouse, and then I can't remember the time scale, but maybe a year or 5 years later, he went to see it, and he just turned it off after the first frame. He just couldn't watch it, you know. So these are men who came back and made great movies. So you've seen, for example, you haven't seen "It's a Beautiful, It's a Wonderful Life."
I have, a long time ago.
A long time ago, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, we have to watch more movies from the 40s and 50s. I think, no?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, what you're saying sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
I think it's a real document, you know, historical document basically. And it's just great that now it can be analyzed. Not just that at the time it provided so much information, but even that now, you know, it gives us so much information about what was going on at the time. Kind of from, you know, it's a direct source, which is always what a historian wants first, no? First-hand information.
Well, that's exactly what it is. But also, if you think of movies like American Sniper, Clint Eastwood's case study of that sniper who has the highest death toll or kill rate of any American sniper. These kind of movies that even Platoon, Oliver Stone, looking at the effects of Vietnam. But there's some really great movies that they made. There was one documentary that wasn't released for years after, when they profile veterans with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and from their induction in the special treatment center and going through it in their therapy sessions individually and as a group. And it's such a sensitive characterization of them. It's there's a lot of humanity in that, you know. And this vocabulary of looking after veterans and post-traumatic stress disorder is just entering the vocabulary, you know, kind of slowly since maybe the Vietnam War, for example. And you could argue that a lot of veterans aren't looked after very properly nowadays either, you know, because I think there's a lot of abandonment when they come back and a lot of issues, you know. So there's that documentary. There's other movies where, for example, there's a scene where it's so you boys are going home then, yeah? And they have to sign some paper, and this guy signs it, and it's just his hook, you know, with a pen and stuff like that, you know? And it's just everybody's kind of shocked, because they're coming back with emotional scars and physical scars as well. And there's another movie where there's a beautiful shot, but it's about a former B-52 pilot And his wife just can't understand why he can't let go of the war. And like she says, like, it's over now. It's like, leave it alone. And he's like, yeah, okay, I'll leave it alone. It's just as easy as that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of the movie, he finds like a graveyard of planes where like they put all the planes they're not using anymore. Mm-hmm. He just climbs into one and there's a great shot from behind. It's just, you know, it's just, you know, it's like a lot of like social commentary and talking about like just these people and what they've come back with, you know? I mean, this is called the Greatest Generation because of all the sacrifices they made. And, you know, maybe how it just they were just weren't understood by the people that they were protecting, you know. So in all aspects, from who they were before the war, the things that they filmed during the war, and the men they were after the war, and the movies that they made after the war as directors, like they made their best movies, and the type of subject matter that they covered as well. It's a documentary series of true brilliance, and I can't recommend it enough.
Well, that was really interesting, just from the passion with which you speak about it. It is, you know,
sings.
You make everybody want to watch it, for sure.
Exactly. Well, they should. The whole point of this podcast.
We don't get any, you know, commission or...
No,
from Netflix, sadly.
Especially, well, exactly, yeah. But don't worry, we do this out of love for the art form. Also, the BBC World Service podcast. There's a great podcast about kamikaze pilots, which is talking to pilots who survived and didn't actually die, even though they're designated kamikaze pilots. So it's an interesting area, no matter what angle you look at it. So, any final comments for this segment, part two?
No, I'm just, well, I'm speechless. I was completely absorbed by the narrative.
Very good. I my voice is sore now. So, Jesus. Okay, so, on that note, yes, we'll wrap up this part two, and we march yet again towards the inevitable part three. This was an ARPA Media podcast. Thank you for listening. As we previously stated in part one, you can find us on Audioboom, iTunes, iHeart, and a number of other platforms. You can also find us on Twitter with ARPA1 and with our website, alarpamedia.com. Also, be sure to check out our videos on our YouTube channel, and you can find us under the handle ARPA. You're listening to Subsound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the ARPA podcast.